Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. I'm thrilled today to be talking with Hans Lukas Kieser, author of an outstanding new biography of Talat Pasha. Kieser offers a distinctive perspective on the history surrounding the First World War by examining it from the perspective of Istanbul, by focusing on Ottoman decisions and visions, especially that of the leading member of the Committee of Union and Progress. Kieser is able to shed new light on the mass violence against the Armenians and other Christian minorities during the war. It's a fascinating book, and I learned a lot from it. I'm looking forward to talking with Hans Lukas about the book today. So, Hans Lukas, welcome, and thanks for joining us on New Books in Genocide Studies.
Yeah, hi, Kelly. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you for this opportunity to talk on the book.
Well, it's a great book, and I'm looking forward to chatting about it. So, but before we do that, maybe you could just say something about yourself and how you became an academic and how you became interested in the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah, that was quite a long way. I was a student of history at the University of Zurich in the 80s. And that was just after the military putsch in Turkey, you know, the great military putsch with a repression, especially on the university youth of activists, and many fled to Europe, also to Switzerland. And that was then an encounter for me with these with such people coming to Basel, and I had then moved to Basel. And suddenly history became different. It got some much more urgency from me because nobody could really explain me all the whole background. So it for me history in its full contemporary sense and Turkish history, Middle Eastern history started with encounters in a workers' neighborhood in the town of Basel, and it took years until I started then to do real research at the end of the 80s. I went into Paris because there were good opportunities to study also the Ottoman language, and I started then really to become a historian of the modern Near East, as we say in Europe, and of Turkey, especially Turkey as the successor state of the Ottoman Empire, and started in a way to read, to write books that I had wanted to read in the early 80s. And where I had felt a real lack of intellectual food.
So why this book now? Why write about Talat Pasha?
Yeah, I was in a way reluctant to draw near to the power holders. I was much more interested in history from below. In the provinces, in the periphery, in the people who suffered repression or marginalization. So I did a lot of studies and wrote also a lot on Kurds, on Alevis, on the Armenians, and did this also, for example, on the important basis of American missionary sources. But in a way, I felt then more and more the necessity and in a way the duty to research also the center after so much studies about the periphery and those below. And so I finally took the... I finally then confront met the challenge. I could now not find the words. There is a German word, den Stier bei den Hörnern packen. So really attack the issue. So finally I got the courage, also the means, thanks to an Australian fellowship. That's why I'm in Australia now. I profit from a future fellowship from the Australian Research Council. And that has allowed me then to fully elaborate what was already in my mind, what I had partly started. That is this biography, this critical biography of Talat, the main figure of the Committee of Union and Progress. So the main power holder, the seminal politician in the Ottoman Middle East of the 1910s. So that's what I now have could finish this year. I feel now liberated from a long work and duty. Yeah, but happy to have done it. Yeah.
So we were talking earlier. I know this took you years to write. What? How available were the sources for this? Did you find the sources that you expected? How hard was it to track down what you needed to know to write this book?
I would say I found largely what I wanted because I was already a historian. Quite versed in what is possible with regard to the archives. Let's say the only archive where I could not do systematical studies are the military archives in Ankara, because Al-Talat, even if he was not the Minister of War, but that is typical for this figure, for this imposing figure, has a lot to do also with the army and with the special organization. So there is a lot of his documents with his names also in the military archives. But they have a totally selective a way of giving documents or not giving documents. Already the access is rather difficult. So I did not play this game and had a lot of other archives. And also what is probably the most important source, I had diaries. This is because for a biography, you need something more than administrative sources. And so you have seen, you have read the book. I have made use especially of three diaries that are accessible since very recently only. And all in all, I have found the diversity, variety of sources that I wanted, also from Armenian sources, from ARF, Armenian Revolutionary Federation sources, memoirs of Armenian figures, to German sources, which are very important, both the official sources of the foreign ministry and the private sources, what was written as memoirs and others, letters of Germans present there. And I have used Austrian also, French, British, American sources. So I would say it's a very broad basis, but as the what has given me the closest access to the personality, let's say the vibrant part or the window that gave me access to the character of the person, that was especially the diary of Talat's collaborator Javid Bey. So the Minister of the Finances, yeah.
Well, maybe we can start by just asking you, what was Talat like as a person? Where did he grow up? What was he like to talk to? What would people who met him say about him? What kind of person was he?
Yeah, he is the child of a lower middle class family in Edirne, that is in the European part of Ottoman Turkey, but also of today's Turkey. It's not far from the frontier to Greece, and he lost early his father, so he was the only male in a family with sisters and his mother. And he went to school, but did not finish his secondary school because he had troubles with his teachers. He even must have struck a teacher so that he was instantaneously dismissed then from school. So he is one of these of the self-made men that we know from history who had not really studied, but who nevertheless then acquired a quite important knowledge, at least the knowledge they needed for what they wanted, and they wanted power, and that's very clear. That's a key notion in Talat's biography. And but this, of course, came step by step. Talat came very early, already as a teenager, in touch with the Young Turk Turk opposition in the underground against the Sultan Abdulhamid. And the Committee of Union on Progress, which is a crucial organization in this biography, was founded at the end of the 1880s at the Military School of Medicine in Istanbul, and it established a kind of a network, a secret network during the 90s. And Talat himself came then into contact with members of this network in Edirne and challenged he felt close to this kind of discourse, patriotic discourse, but also subversive discourse, rebellious discourse. And he was then imprisoned because of these contacts and activities of that cell in Edirne, and came later free after more than a year, and could get a post in Saloniki, so that's also in the European, at that time, European Ottoman Turkey. Now it's Thessaloniki, it's in Greece. And Saloniki was later really the center of the Committee of Union and Progress. And Talat built up this center. So he was a master networker in the underground. And that is an absolute distinctive feature of his personality. So he is a secretive conspirationist, a networker who was very talented in making contacts, in motivating people, bringing them together, organizing a whole group and also intimidating, if necessary, people who could have been a risk for this group, including intimidating to kill already, also before the revolution. And so he managed to build up this center of the Young Turks in opposition in Saloniki. And the second center, of course, was in exile in Europe, first in Geneva, then in Paris. And they fused in 1907. And Talat was the representative, informal representative of the Saloniki Center. And Dr. Nazem that coming from Paris, and that was the preparation then of the Young Turk Revolution. A year later, at that time, the Armenian Revolutionary Federation was part of this pact, of this joint venture, and that's how finally they got really on the political surface, as the Committee of Union Progress, with the Young Turk Revolution of July 1908. They had not already the persons, the politicians that could have executive posts. So still Abdul Hamid, the Sultan, remained at his place, and his figures, his experienced politicians would continue, but according to the directives of the committee, and this means also the directives of Talat. In contrast to a few years later, Talat at this stage was one among several important committee members, especially these military doctors, so Dr. Nazim and also Dr. Aydin Shakir. They had a better education, they had been a long time in Europe, so they had in the committee itself a very strong stand. And Talat was certainly not simply the first person or a primus inter pares, but already he started to be the face of the committee then. And in 1909, he was the first minister of the first minister of the CUP, of the Committee of Union Progress. That is the first who got an executive post together with Javid, whom I mentioned already, the finance minister. Then also in summer 1909. So he already became visible and more than the others, the eminence grise, as one calls them also, these military doctors who were at that time so important. They remained very important in the committee, but could never, what was Talat's strength, combine both a strong position in the secretive committee and a strong position in the visible public politics, in the parliament, and in the government. So that's the key for Talat's power, is that he combined both power sources. Of course, at that time, he was a greenhorn. He was totally new in politics. And it took him several years to then be able to become really the first figure. This is the case in 1913. So there were crises in between. There was also the big crisis already in April 1909 with the counter putsch of Islamist forces, but partly also supported by liberal forces, because already then there was the fear that the Committee of Union and Progress would become authoritarian, what it became, in fact, very much a few years later. So it was a complex counterputch already a few months after the Young Turk Revolution. Then he became a minister together with Javid, then also others. But he was finally disillusioned from the parliamentary life. So this crisis that we see in his life, which has different dimensions, the political crisis, as I just described, disillusion with democracy, with parliamentarism, goes hand in hand with a personal crisis. The doctor says him that he will not be able to father a child. He was just freshly married in 1912, and the same year in July was a putsch against a government dominated by the Young Turks, as by the Committee of Union and Progress, that Talat and the other ministers were dismissed, and the party was very much threatened of dissolution by so-called liberal, the so-called liberals who came to the power in that July of 1912. So that was a very critical year, and the Talat that we see then in the 1910s and during World War One is very much informed by this crisis that made a radical and a warmonger out from him. Before, he was widely seen, and especially also by Armenian colleagues, as or comrades or brothers, as they called themselves, political brothers, as revolutionaries, as they understood one the other, the revolutionaries of the 1908, the brothers of the, in this political sense. He was seen until then as a democrat, or comparatively as a democrat who had a vision of new interactions between the different elements of the empire, and of new political fundaments based on the constitution of 1908. And so we have very much to take into account the development of the personality and the turns and changes. And I really emphasize this development and turn in Talat's political life, but combined to his personal life in the second half of 1912, when he then sees the solution for the political problem, but maybe also for the personal problem, in a very proactive, warmonger attitude. So, and also a populist, to a certain extent, a populist attitude. I said that the committee had been very secretive, and the military doctors I mentioned were secretive persons. They were not public persons. Talat was already, to a certain extent, a public person since the Young Turk Revolution, but now he became also an orator. So he made speeches together with others that called for war against the Balkan states in the fall of 1912. So normally you read in the textbooks, and that's not wrong, but it's not the whole picture, that aggressive Balkan states attacked the Ottoman Empire. But if you look now, what happened with these Young Turks in the opposition for a moment because of the July Putsch 1912, they wanted war. At any price, they wanted war. And they called the people, the students, all the intelligentsia, the press. And they had quite some support, and the liberals were not so severe in their repressions of the Young Turks in a temporary opposition. They could have been totally dissoluted at that time. So we see Talat as a warmonger, as a populist, as a public orator, as very subversive, as wanting war, calling to war against these Balkan states, and war then finally comes in the October of 1912, and this is dramatically lost by an insufficiently prepared Ottoman army. And in a way, that's what played into the game of course of Talat, because this allowed him then to prepare, not alone, but as the mastermind of the whole action, the putsch of January 1913, which was decisive for the establishment of the Young Turk single party rule that lasted until the fall of 1918.
So So that's a wonderful narrative. And you point out this moment where Talat and people around him reimagine the future for the Ottoman Empire. So what is his vision for the future? What does he want to have happen? What does he want the Ottoman Empire to look like as he's involved in these events in 1912 and 1913?
Yeah. That's again, it's really a turning point. Before, one could have believed, but of course, that's not so sure. And Shukri Haniolo, our colleague in Princeton, was very right in making clear how strongly Turkists were already members of the Committee of Union and Progress even before 1908. But nevertheless, there was a constitutional enthusiasm. So a vision for the Ottoman future based on a more democratic, on a constitution and a revised, more democratic constitution also. And we cannot deny that Talat shared in this vision, at least to a certain extent. We have already, before his crisis, some clear signs that he does no longer really share in this vision, but it became entirely clear that he has changed and that he follows other visions with this turn of late 1912, and then of course the establishment of the single party rule, and so your question was what was then the vision for the empire. So that was it was really a different vision. It was still imperial, so in this sense it was that was a common trait, but it was not imperial in the sense of democratic or more democratic, diverse, balanced, perhaps to a certain extent, federal Ottoman Empire. Also the Young Turks were always reluctant against any regionalization. They were always centralist. One must clearly see this. But he became even more centralist. And what was totally different was a more and more explicit Turkish nationalism or Turkism that made these imperial actors imperial nationalist actors. So that sounds like a paradox, but this means that they had a very strong now identification with the new nationalist current, an ethno-nationalist current, that had as the most important, as its most important prophet and ideologue at that time, Ziya Gökalp, a close friend of Talat, also member of the Central Committee. Also, then in Saloniki, he came from Diyarbakir, but settled down in Saloniki in 1909. So this new the nationalist Turkish current really reshapes the imperial self-understanding of these young imperial actors, and makes them radical in the sense that their nationalist enthusiasm gives them ideas that are partly exuberant and sure, certainly in to a large extent, very intolerant vis-à-vis the other non-Turkish elements of the empire. So what we call before Ottomanism, that is the idea of a common Ottoman coexistence based on a constitution, disappears more and more. And what takes the center stage is this new Turkism, but we must be very clear, which is a Muslim Turkism. So it's very much mixed with an understanding, a selective understanding of Islam. Gökalp takes the theological claim of supremacy from Sunni Islam and combines it with this new pan-Turkist vision and self-understanding, both culturally at that time. The expression is mostly cultural. Then during the World War I, it becomes also political at the start already. And so that's a very new outlook, an outlook that is that does not know limits. So you had before the humble, wisdom among many Ottoman actors around 1908, that the main challenge would be to hold the empire together, or even if one would lose certain parts, then at least to build up from the interior a better, more prosperous, also politically more solid and possibly more democratic society. Now, this domestic constructive aspects, in a way, loses its importance, its urgency. Because a much bigger, greater, much more appealing ideology is there, that not only wants the real restoration of the empire, but even the expansion. And in any case, it wanted Asia Minor, that's Anatolia, as a national home for the Turks. So again, we have something like a paradox, a national home of the Turks, but it's an empire. It's not a paradox. It's this historical fact of what others also call a national imperialists who combine a vision of a nation state with empire. Which was anyways comparably the case with the colonial empires of the European nation states. Yeah, so that's Talat, that's the Committee of Union on Progress in 1913 and before, at the eve of World War I.
So at the very just before the war, there's a decision made by Talat and other people in the government in the need to, I guess you would call, cleanse a group of people. And I hope I'm pronouncing this right. The room, is that right?
The room, yeah. The Greek Orthodox Ottoman cities.
Yeah, what does that tell us about how this imagined future, how the Talat intended to put this imagined future into place? Why the decision to remove these Greek Orthodox, and what does that say about the direction of Talat's policies?
Yeah, so as I just said, so in any case, Anatolia should become national home for the Turks, so under the exclusive sovereignty, politically, but also economically, culturally. And now this removal, expulsion of the Rum at the Aegean coast, so in the greater region of Izmir, this was part of this vision of national home Anatolia, but I re-emphasize within an imperial vision. And of course, it was very strongly also a resentful reaction, but a resentful reaction with a lot of rationality against to the losses during the Balkan Wars, when there were thousands of Muslim migrants, refugees, or people who were expelled from during war, during the Balkan Wars. So it was a kind of a revenge. That is, by the way, an absolute keyword in the Young Turk publications of the time. So revenge is what they call for, and it is part of the revenge against the victory of Greece to expel these people and to make place for Muslims of coming from the Balkans. Yeah, at the same time, we see it now retrospectively as a first very important part of a very broad demographic engineering that went on in the decade to come.
You make a point in the book, a good point, about the need to see things from Istanbul as opposed to Paris or Britain. Or London or Berlin. So in 1914, as Talat's looking around from Istanbul, how does he see the world, and why does he think that war is the right answer to the challenges facing the empire?
Yeah, so you mean the First World War, the Great War.
Yeah. Although it, I suppose, didn't have to be the First World War. You talk at least in part about the danger that there would be a Greco-Ottoman conflict that from which World War I could have emerged if history had gone differently.
Yeah, sure. So he is really in the war modus, Talat, since the fall of 1912. So war is for him not only legitimate; it is a real the key to solutions and in a gamble that he accepts, because there were a lot of losses and we can only gamble and then perhaps we will win. That's one must see that in this sense there was a different political mentality in Istanbul. And after all the events in the Balkans, already before the Balkan Wars, with rebellions, with guerrillas, with political assassinations, which were nearly a normality. And so the assassination in Sarajevo was not very special for special news for Istanbul, whereas it was special news for Europe. So they were experienced in dealing with such events, and experienced in looking for advantages, perhaps to take from crisis, profiting from crisis. That's something that Europe in the Belle Époque was not so much used to do, at least not in Europe itself. Yeah, the colonies are a partly different world. Talat really prepared war against Greece. Not only Talat, Enver, so the single party regime, because they wanted to take back islands near to the Anatolian coast. By the way, the same islands recently Erdogan said they must be Turk. So it's not so old an issue. It's quite a topical issue, as is much of what I had to write in this book. A lot is very topical, including now this issue of the islands that was Aegean islands that was a main reason for the single party regime to prepare war and to do all to acquire warships and also to have the audacity or daredevilry to expulse 200,000 people. Imagine this in peace times, such an expulsion. And it's really astonishing that the European diplomacy did not react more decisively. But again, one must see all factors. At the same time, the reform plan for the eastern provinces, including Armenians, Kurds, and others, had been signed. So there was also a lot of hope, and one did not want to put an obstacle now into the realization of these reforms in the eastern part of Asia Minor with a too severe reaction against what the Talat did in the West. So we have a really particular situation with both signs of peace and peaceful futures and signs of war and a future of war in this spring of 1914. But what we must say, looking from Istanbul, and that's your question, these people at the top of the committee and Talat as the first one, they calculated with war. So they wanted war with Greece, they prepared war with Greece. Of course, they wanted war once they were ready to win the war. And they were not so badly surprised when there was the July crisis in Europe. On the contrary, they were quite happy because that gave them the chance to finally conclude an alliance with an European great power, what they always had wanted and always had been refused. And Wangenheim, the German ambassador, still refused, was reluctant at the first moment when they came to him asking for an alliance after mid-July 1914. And then we have this famous note of Kaiser Wilhelm at the margin of a telegram. Wangenheim must change. We will need every rifle for a war that is preparing. And so that's how this alliance then comes to be concluded on the 2nd of August. And we see very happy young Turks, very, very happy, enthusiastic Talat on these days. We can read this in the diary of Cavit, who was with all these guys. He just came back from Europe and he saw them and he was perplexed because Cavit is the one in the committee who has often a bit different more skeptical attitude, but they are happy, and the press of the committee press, which anyway is put in line since the single party rule, they write articles that show Schadenfreude, that is happiness on the fact that now Europe is experiencing catastrophe as the Ottoman Empire had experienced during the Balkan Wars.
With the alliance with Germany, how does Talat plan to win the war?
He is overconfident as far as Germany is concerned. He's not the only one to be overconfident. They see Germany as an invincible power. And of course, Germany was a very impressive power. One might forget this in retrospective, but Germany was the locomotive in economy, in military, and very upcoming, promising world power in the early 20th century. So he was overconfident. So he believed that with Germany at his side, the war would anyway be won. And so the gamble was very audacious. So the gamble included just from the start, because the war started, in fact, not with the official entrance of the Ottoman Empire into the war at the end of October, so after the events of the attack at the end of the October against the Black Sea, Russian Black Sea towns, but it started immediately in August with the preparations, with guerrilla activities at the Caucasus front. And the gamble was very audacious that this penetration of the Russian front in the Caucasus and then the conquest of the Caucasus, including Baku, also up to the Caspian Sea. It included the reconquest of Egypt, which the Britain Britain was the protector, had Egypt as under its administration since the late 19th century, but it annexed it then with the outbreak of First World War. So a very audacious gamble, partly or largely based on overconfidence on Germany, but also, as I said, on this new ideological outlook that lacked a balanced and sober understanding of geopolitics.
So that's the idea, is that they will rely on, or they will work with an exceptionally powerful German state to win the war, and their immediate contribution to this will be this offensive in the Caucasus. As you point out in the book, the kind of chronology here has become important in terms of how people try and explain the decisions about the actions against Armenians in April or May. So can you walk us through kind of the chronology in those next few months of what happens in the fall and winter of 1914, 1915, and what that says about Talat's and other people's attitudes toward Armenians in the spring of 1915?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also, these are really questions we discussed now for years very intensively. Yeah. And so now what's the main picture that emerges from Talat's biography, political biography? So on one point is important. So and may a little bit change the picture we have, not entirely. Even we have got in recent research, we have a very aggressive top. We have very aggressive top leaders, especially Enver and Talat, and also Talat. Often one reads in the textbook and in research that Talat was reluctant, and only Enver was the only one who wanted war. I think I can very clearly show that this was not the case. Just Talat was the better diplomat, and he could play with different faces towards different representatives in Istanbul. But in fact, he was in agreement with Enver in the main points, and especially also with regard to war in the Caucasus, which is now our
which is really a main argument and the main background for the Armenian genocide. So it is important to see this war in the Caucasus prepared and partly implemented from August 1914 as a guerrilla war with many deaths already and killing of civilians and robbing of them because also these milices that were also put up beside the regular army, they lacked often the necessary material and food, so robbing and attacking Christian villages on the one or the other side of the frontier was a means to provide what was needed. So it's very important to see this as a general picture in at the Caucasus front from the Black Sea to northern Iran. So it's a very broad front that is put up already. And it's partly already gets brutalized very early. It is also important to see that Talat already at that stage, that is in early September, sends a circular telegram in which he orders to the governors in those provinces, but quite large, as in Eastern Asia Minor, to very closely survey the Armenian organizations, Armenian leaders, Armenian intelligentsia, and to prepare all to arrest them if necessary. So that's something one must know. This does not mean that there is now a blueprint to genocide. There is not. It is this, what I said. But that's very important. It is, of course, a step toward the selection of the whole group already. And then we see that nearly all the campaigns fail in this first half year. So the campaign into the Caucasus fails catastrophically at the end of December. So the campaign then that was led with the regular army that enters the game after the official entrance into war in November and also the conquest of Egypt. By Cemal Pasha's army fails in early 1914, and also there is a defeat in southern Iraq. So it's a very depressive time in late January and February. And then, it's nearly paralysis, and Talat as a person is very visibly depressed. Javid writes how depressed he saw his friend, and it is then this decisive victory on the 18th of March against this naval breakthrough or attempt at a naval breakthrough in the Dardanelles. This first victory that in a way changes the situation, galvanizes again this aggressive spirit and enables then Talat and the committee to again proactively take the affairs into their hands and to be even more audacious and murderous in this case in their planning of the near future. So the planning of the attack against the Armenians is something that we see being done, and we see it being done both because these decisive people meet, those coming back from the Eastern Front with all the fresh observations and experience and ideas also. And of course, the main actors, the main leaders in the capital. So this said, I should perhaps add that already at a very severe repression of Armenian leaders had started then in late 1914, related to this campaign that led by Enver that finally failed catastrophically at Zarikamish. But there was not the confidence, the daredevil confidence that one could do such big a thing and murderous a thing as a genocide, as we call it today, at that time, because depression then began to reign, and in this sense also a political passivity, and this was only then turned after March, and went together with this first very important victory that was followed then by other victories in the defense of the capital on the peninsula of Gallipoli. So the decision then to attack frontally and totally the Armenians is something that emerges at that time and is not done by Talat alone. So it is, there come several very radical suggestions by governors and by the leader of the special organization, which is an organization, secretive, militant organization for special actions that is fully in the hand of the Committee of Union and Progress, and it, not only of Enver but also Talat. The correspondence shows this very clearly. So this leader, that's Baitin Shakir, so one of the Eminence Gris, comes back to Istanbul, and then come telegram arrive from the east, from governors suggesting very radical action, including the extermination regionally of Armenians. So it is Talat who synthesizes this all and put it and operationalizes it in his telegrams of the 24th of April, which start with the attack on the Armenian leadership and intelligentsia. And then one again can argue rightly, but that's not already the genocide, that's the attack on the intelligentsia. Yes, but very soon, a few weeks later, we see then the first measures taken by Talat, partly suggested by governors on the spot, against the whole populations of eastern provinces. And from June, there emerges the picture of a total removal of the Armenians from the whole of Asia Minor, starting, of course, in the eastern provinces. But it is absolutely clear then in July. And that's also what the ambassador Wangenheim then very clearly puts, when he writes to Berlin, that now it's the extermination of the Armenian race in the Turkish-Ottoman Empire that takes place.
You make a point in the book about the Ottoman, I don't know if tradition is the right word, but the fact that the Ottomans have used policies of removal and persecution in the years before World War One and before the Committee of Union and Progress, that there, I don't know if a tradition of this kind of policy is the right way to put it, but at least there are examples of this kind of a policy of removal. Does he see himself as acting in a longer tradition of Ottoman policy, or does he see himself advocating and his colleagues advocating and accomplishing something distinctively different.
No, he's clearly, his conscience is clearly and outspokenly that of a revolutionary who brings new, something new, who creates a new Turkey. That's already a slogan of his era, and who uses new patterns and who boasts that he did in 3 months much more against the Armenians than Sultan Abdul Hamid had done in 30 years. And under Abdul Hamid, you know, there was were terrible massacres of more than 100,000 Armenians in the 1890s. So he boasted with having done something much bigger and of a new dimension. And so it's, of course, he is an imperially biased, very strategically in my book. I use this notion of the imperial bias. So he acts in a tradition of an imperial bias, meaning that power relation is a key key reference for his political personality. But it is the new dimension of a Europe of the extremes that, in a way, starts there. Because my book very clearly puts the Ottoman Empire into a larger or greater Europe. And it is the first genocide within Europe. In this sense, and he is the one who was politically capable, to put it cynically, to do this, and he is conscious that he is acting in a new dimension and a new radicality, as demanded by a revolutionary of the 20th century, in his self-understanding.
In a similar kind of question, we talked about the removal of the Greek Orthodox Christians. You also point out the, destruction is maybe the right word, of Assyrian Christians during the war. Does Talat see these population movements and destructions as all of one piece? Is this, or is the treatment of the Armenians somehow different?
Certainly, we can speak of an overall demographic engineering. This is certainly the pictures that emerges historically when we analyze the whole situation and the policy as a whole. So, with regard to with regard to the Assyrians or the Syriac people, we do not have the same policy explicitly written down, ordered by Talat, as with the Armenians. We have exactly the same persecution in certain provinces of Eastern Asia Minor, but mostly due to the action of local governors or local authorities, including officers. But it's not the record in the Ottoman archive from the Ministry of the Interior. So Talat acted as the Minister of the Interior during all this time, before he became a Grand Vizier in 1917. So he had the idea to attack the Assyrians in the sense of a removal into the interior already in November. So we have an order by Talat to the governor of one demanding the removal, the deportation of the displacement of these people to the interior. But it's not possible at that time. And then once he turns against the Armenians, in the spring and summer of 1915, he, at a certain moment when the governor of Diyarbakir includes all Christians, that is also the Syriac Christians, then Talat, because of the intervention of the German ambassador, explicitly says to the governor, Dr. Rashid, that the Syriacs are not included in this policy, in these measures, disciplinary measures, as the telegram goes. So we have always to distinguish, yet one can say it is the top of the iceberg, is the extreme of a whole set of demographic engineering. It's the exterminatory the culmination of a broader policy that we see very clearly directed against the Armenians. Explicitly, as far as such a policy ever can be explicit, because we know for all genocide, it's normally never explicit, but as far as it can be explicit, so it was explicit only against the Armenians, and this has several reasons. The Armenians were overproportionally well organized, overproportionally well educated, thus not assimilable to such an ideology as wanted by the single party rule. So dangerous in their view. They were those who had been involved in the state since the Ottoman reforms of the 19th century. They wanted to become equals, including an equal say in the politics. So they were the guys Talat feared most as competition, as actors who had good connections internationally also, so not only organized within the empire. So there are quite a lot of reasons why the Armenians were attacked. Of course, one of the main reasons, if we do the comparison with the Jews, is that they were attackable. They were vulnerable. The Jews were in the Yishuv in Palestine were vulnerable to a certain extent, but Western British French warships could every time come close there, and then the Jews had a much better connection with regard to the capitals, also to the press, and Talat feared additional bad news. So he never wanted to afford something similar to his attack against the Armenians, also against the Jews, because he could not afford to do both at the same time. And anyway, Palestine was not part of the core lands, as of this, what I have called the national core lands, or core land of the empire, so that the Jews, even if they were at risk, they were never at the same risk as were the Armenians. And Cemal Pasha had very clearly to understand when he corresponded with Talat that he could not apply similar measures, even if non-exterminatory measures, that means also measures of a comprehensive expulsion in the case of the Yishuv of the Jews in Palestine, because Talat did not want this. So Talat ordered Cemal, and this is one among many proofs that Talat had the first say in the committee rule. It's not really a triumvirate. That's another revisionist point in my biography. It's Talat's role first, and he orders Cemal Pasha with regard to Palestine, what is to be done and what is not to be done.
So we're drawing to the end of our time. I'd like to change directions a little bit at the end here. And you suggest in your book, it's actually one of the themes of your book, is that Talat and his policies and his example played a really critical role in establishing the basis for Turkey under Mustafa Kemal. So can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah. So that's he really realized the demographic and economic fundament for an exclusively Turkish nation state in Anatolia. Kemal Pasha, the later Atatürk, was the ingenious organizer of the Muslim resistance. At that time, it was a fight in the name of Islam from 1919 to 1922. So he was the organizer of the resistance, himself a former CUP member, and together with the CUP people and with former cadres of Talat, he was successful in defending Asia Minor in its entirety for this reduced project, because it was already a project. The national home, the Türkürdü, had already been a project for 10 years before Mustafa Kemal. So he continued without the imperial dimension what already had been the project of the CUP leaders and Talat in particular. And we see a number of reforms on several levels. So I have mentioned already the demography and the economy, but also other reforms, more positive reforms with regard to the place of the woman, with regard to the revision of the family law, with regard to better education system, with regard to Turkey, to a language reform, Turkish in the mosques, and so on and so forth. We see a lot already, thought of, and not only this, partly already realized, of course, never in that radicality and entirety as then by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk in the interwar period. What is another very clear proof for my statement that Kemal Atatürk is the successor of Talat is the cooperation of both. When Talat was in exile in Berlin and Kemal Pasha had the place of that hold of leadership in Anatolia, they understood themselves as working for the same cause. But Talat now not at the first place and only in from abroad, so internationally, and Kemal at the first place on the ground.
So what should we think of Talat now?
Yeah, what should we think? I think it's a very high time to very soberly, not resentfully, very soberly, clearly see what went wrong. Because that's, I think, an expression we need to see. A lot went wrong in the 1910s, and genocide is the worst aspect of it. No person is totally evil, and Talat, not Talat as well. Yet he stands for a very, very dark shadow, and it's time to speak this openly out in research, in scholarship, but also in politics, because there are so many streets, mosques, and schools with the name of Talat in Turkey and beyond Turkey. And that cannot be. That's wrong public history. That destroys political culture in any constructive democratic sense based on human rights. So it's simply time to look soberly back at this person, his impact, and to learn, finally, lessons. So it's hopefully that I was in a way a deconstructor of Talat in this biography, but as I say, with the hope that this is helpful, because lessons can be learned, even if very belatedly.
Well, it's a wonderful book, and I find myself saying this in a lot of interviews, but it's especially true with you, that the book is far richer than we've had a chance to do it justice. So I encourage listeners to go out and purchase it and read The Argument in Full. And it's a fascinating book. So Hans Lucas, I always ask guests the same final question, and that's pretty simple. And it actually applies for me now. I will be on a plane in a couple nights, so I have ample time to read. What would you suggest to listeners? A book or two, or perhaps a movie? I don't know. What was meaningful to you that you would like other people to read as you thought about the subject?
Yeah. So of course, I could not find the ultimate book on Talat, because in this case I had to write it myself.
Yep.
But there are two books I wanted to mention as an answer to your question. One book is an eyewitness report by Jakob Künzler. The title is In the Lands of Blood and Tears, Experiences in Mesopotamia During the World War. That's a book that very soberly but very impressively shows what happens under Talat's rule in Urfa, so just in a part of the empire. Yeah, and a very readable, not so long book. The other one is closer to the center. It's Armenian Golgotha by Grigoris Balakian. And it's also a very readable book that shows the experiences of an Armenian prelate who is in Istanbul during this time, but then is arrested, is one of those arrested. But in contrast to the majority, manages to survive despite Talat's policy. These are my two recommendations.
Well, your book took, I think you said, almost or perhaps a whole decade to prepare. I guess one reasonable option at this point would be just to relax. But my guess is you're working on something else. Do you have another project you're working on?
Yeah, I am thinking now, and in fact, I'm doing this since several years already, because, as I said, before you started the interview, it takes me a long time before writing a new book. So since a couple of years, I'm thinking about the book on the contemporary Middle East. Now it sounds very differently, but the book that outspokenly deals with the religious factors and the role of eschatology, of apocalyptical literature, of Islam, Jewish faith, and Christian apocalyptical expectations, and not only Sunni Islam, also Shiite Islam. So I wanted, and the thesis is, or the observation from which I start, is that we see a lot of holy scripture on the surface of the political discourses, much more than under Talat. And but you know, you have read the book, there is a lot of religion already, much more than we read in some textbooks. And now we have arrived in a time where we have even more. We have even more Holy Scripture at the surface of the political discourse. And I wanted to do a study on this issue, which will be a kind of a contemporary history of the Middle East, but with this particular, I would say, a crucial focus and key to understand what is going on today.
Well, it sounds like a great project, and I hope you'll come back and talk about it on the New Books Network when you're done. But for now, thank you so much for your time. It's a wonderful book, and I will thank you on behalf of the audience for explaining some high points of it.
Thank you, Kelly, for this conversation.
All right, well, take care.